Coming up on Simply Superior.
Simply Superior news and issues from a superior point of view.
If that sounds like a greeting for the chief, it's actually for the Veep.
My dad took Fritz in a canoe, and one or the other of the two of them stood up in the canoe to wave at all these adoring fans on the bridge over the pool and promptly flipped the canoe, tossing them and all of their gear into the pool river.
Local residents share their memories of Fritz Mondale. Plus,
City of Duluth will host a convention for Hollywood executives.
Last week, we told of the failing financial grade of the Catalyst TV Festival and Story Institute. Now, the nonprofit responds. Those stories and the regional news and review after this.
Simply Superior News. Issues from a superior point of view.
If that sounds like a greeting for the chief, it's actually for the Veep.
My dad took Fritz in a canoe, and one or the other of the two of them stood up in the canoe to wave at all these adoring fans on the bridge over the pool and promptly flipped the canoe, tossing them and all of their gear into the pool river.
Local residents share their memories of Fritz Mondale. Plus,
City of Duluth will host a convention for Hollywood executives.
Last week, we told of the failing financial grade of the Catalyst TV Festival and Story Institute. Now, the nonprofit responds. Welcome to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. If you thought that music was Hail to the Chief, you're wrong. It's actually Hail Columbia, which is the official song to be played for the Vice President of the United States whenever he, and now she, walks into the room. And if you're one of the many people in our area who was around when Walter Mondale walked in the room, you probably didn't hear it either. At least not when he was visiting friends in Duluth, fishing on the Brule, or frequenting one of the finer establishments in Superior. We lost the physical presence of the Minnesota favorite son and 1984 Democratic presidential candidate at age 93 this week, but he lives on in countless memories, and we've got several. Starting them off is Tom Rauschenfels of Duluth. And you met Walter Mondale when, or you got to protect him?
Yeah, it was 1980, and it was January, and we're kind of in the gray doldrums of winter where really nothing happening. And I was on National Ski Patrol. I patrolled for 32 years out at Spirit Mountain. And I got a call from the patrol director, and he said, "I see your shift is this weekend, 8 to 5 on Saturday and Sunday." He said, "Are you going to be there? You don't have any subs. You don't have anybody that's going to be subbing for you." And I said, "Yep, I'm planning on it. Usual Group B patrol." And to be honest with you, I don't remember if he gave a reason why he needed to know that, because he had never called before. It was just, you're kind of on your honor. You sign up, you do your shift, and then you go home.
Mm-hmm.
And so got there Saturday, and then up pulls a big limo. Gold Cross Ambulance was already at Spirit Mountain, and that was strange because that never usually happened. You didn't call an ambulance unless there was a severe injury that needed to go back to the hospital via ambulance. Well, long story short, Vice President Mondale was skiing that day at Spirit Mountain. Why he chose Spirit, I don't know. Probably up visiting friends in town. I know he had lots of friends in Duluth, northern Minnesota. And I don't even remember who was skiing with him that day, except Secret Service agents.
And that's pretty funny to think about, you know, because they have to figure out how to match his pace, right? I don't know how you do that on skis.
Yeah, well, that plus you got to hope there's some Secret Service guys that can ski, which I'm assuming, there must be a few of them there that can.
In their suits.
Yeah, in their suits. And so our whole mission that day was to make sure that when Vice President Mondale got on the chairlift, there were always two or three chairs behind him that nobody could get on, and that if we skied down the hill near him, we had to make sure there weren't too many people near him. But anyways, it was a fun day. It was a great day. And I do remember seeing lots of very tall, very official-looking people in the chalet that whole day while he was there. And then the nice thing about it, at the end of the day, he stopped by the patrol room as we were all getting out of our equipment and thanked us for a wonderful day. And that still sticks out in my mind.
All right. About how long was it, by the way? Did he just go down once and go away, or?
You know, I think he stayed for about 3-4 hours from about midday, maybe slightly after noon, till about probably 4:30, somewhere in that.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, it wasn't quite trying out for the Olympics, but what would you give him, 9.0, 9.1?
Oh, he was good. He's a decent skier. No, I was mildly surprised that he got down the hill really nicely. Yeah, good above-intermediate skier, I think, if I had to give it a classification.
All right. And we're talking to Tom Rauschenfels of Duluth. Thank you for sharing it.
Yeah, you bet, Robin. Take care.
And we are talking to Joe Heller of Duluth, correct?
Yes, sir.
And you have a Mondale story.
First, I want to send out my deepest sympathies to the Mondale family. Fritz was an icon and a true hero to me. I've met him over more than half a dozen times. And my sons met him. And it's just a devastating loss to a straight-up, stand-up, great human being. Mm-hmm. And I've been in politics since I was 16, driving around people like Paul Belt Wellstone. I drove when Paul was up here. I drove Yvonne Pretner Solon. I used to go get Sam Solon all the time and drive him to his political events. You know, the old school Duluth.
Mm-hmm. You know, one thing, as you're talking about driving them around, Mondale was not a stranger to our area. He was up here a lot, correct?
Oh, all the time. There's a lot of the guys up here, that the old timers, that as soon as they're done with a political event or a stump, they'd go out fishing all the time all over this place. The vast majority of the times, I swear on everything holy, the only reason Fritz would want to come up here during the summertime is he would either go fishing or go along the lake. He loved Canal Park. It was just to get away. Uh-huh. And I think Duluth and Superior, I remember a couple times him going over to Superior, that he would do it just to get out of the cities.
Uh-huh. What did he do in Superior? Or is that a secret? Do we ever tell what people do in Superior?
Yeah, we will. What goes on in Superior sometimes stays in Superior. But there was a few times that I had to go get Fritz back in the day, or one of our elected officials from an establishment, a union hall, or a union meeting, would they had a tendency to meet in one of the finer establishments in Superior.
Of course, the finer establishments.
The very finest establishments, as long as it was union.
The very fine establishments.
Oh, my God. Now you're bringing back other memories. Oh, my God. Anyhow.
Those are going to stay in Superior. Yeah. So, your story, your personal story.
So, a few years back, there was a notion to change how Duluth used to do their voting process. I always find that Duluth's voting process is fair, but there's a newer way that people wanted and how we vote, you know, more lines like ranked choice voting they wanted to do. Well, it was a hard, hard election, right? We had people from, you know, all over the place campaigning one side or another to change Duluth's election. And myself, I like how Duluth votes, you know, one vote, one person, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm out door knocking, and somehow Fritz got a hold of one of the old timers and says, "Hey, Joel," he says, "do you think if I wrote a letter to the Duluth News Tribune that it would help?" And we all go, "Yes." So 3 days, 4 days before the election, Fritz writes this beautiful op-ed in the letters to the editors, just beautiful. And it explains why he was dead set against ranked choice voting. And I'm just chuckling because I know this might actually help immensely, right? Fritz is popular beyond belief in Duluth. He is loved not as towards the politics, but as a person. People love Fritz. So 2 days before the election, I'm out in West End there, right by Denfield High School. And I'm knocking, and this nice lady comes to the door, and she says, "How can I help you, sir?" And well, I introduce, hi, my name is Joel Heller, and I'm here to speak against ranked choice voting. And before I could go to that thing, she says, is this the letter that Fritz wrote in the paper? I says, yes, ma'am, it is. And she looks at me straight in the face. And all 78 years of her looked at me. And she says, well, I read that article. And if Fritz says it's bull, then it was bull. And I went, well, yes, ma'am. I left that building that day with a homemade pumpkin pie in one hand and a smile saying, I think we got this whipped. 2 days later, we won huge. I think we beat ranked choice voting by like 10,000 votes or something like that.
Well, I think he beat it for a good 20 years. It didn't materialize for quite a while in the city.
So that's my loving story. I got many other ones.
But we'll keep the ones from Superior in Superior, right?
Yeah, but keep the ones in Superior in Superior.
All right. Thank you, Joel Heller from Duluth.
All right. Thank you.
Well, we're talking to Duke Skorich and Patty McNulty of Duluth, and you have Mondale Encounters to tell us about.
Oh, we certainly do. Robin, and thanks so much for giving us the opportunity to talk about somebody who has been, well, a friend of both of our parents and ours as well. It's difficult to find anybody who grew up in Minnesota in a Democratic household who didn't at some point have some encounter with Fritz Mondale.
Well, particularly our area, he liked coming up here, too. So that's what really made it special,
well,
right?
Well, yes. I mean, he spent so much time up north. And even during, you know, his days as a senator, yes, his days as a vice president. And then when he was out of office, there were many opportunities where he would spend weeks in northern Minnesota at various fishing camps and then at friends of ours who have fishing camps in Canada. So he absolutely loved the outdoors. Love to be on the water and love to be with those friends of his. My relationship with him began as a young boy when he was attending Christmas parties for my parents at my parents' house. And of course, that meant he was there with Hubert Humphrey. He was there sometimes with Orville Freeman, John Blotnick. You know, the whole legacy of Democratic Minnesota Democratic politics. And I remember in 1976, Robin, when Fritz decided he was not going to run for president. And I was at a news conference with him at another event. And so I was going to ask him a question. But before I could even get to him, he looked at me and he called me Dookie. And he said, Dookie, okay. You're going to want to turn on your camera, Dookie, because you're going to want to get what I have to say on the news tonight. And he announced at that point that he was not going to be a candidate in 1976 for president.
But that election worked out for him after
all. Well, it did. I mean, yes, it did. And I happened to be in Madison Square Garden then in 1980, in August of 1980, when President Carter and Walter Mondale were renominated by the party. And so that was another happy moment to be with him. But later in life, when he was out of office, I would see him in town as he was traveling north for fishing trips. And he always stopped and he would sit with me, give me a half hour, 40 minutes of his time. And we would talk politics, and some of it I would record and use on the news. But more or less, it was just him catching up.
Mm-hmm. How about you, Patty?
Well, my favorite story about Walter Mondale isn't really about an interaction because I didn't speak with him that day, but it's about a moment that to me just capsulized who he was. When Judge Gerald Haney died, the man for whom our local federal office building is named, Duke and I were at the funeral, went to the graveside, and it was sort of a gray, misty day, a lot of people because Gerald Haney was another big fixture and Minnesota politics and certainly the legal community in this area. So a lot of people are at the graveside and they have a pretty standard graveside service, as you would expect. And people are walking away after this is all over. And I looked across and there off just to the side of where the crowd had been, standing all alone is a man holding an umbrella, because I said it was misty, And it was Walter Mondale. He didn't go into the crowd. He didn't draw attention to himself. He quietly came up from the Twin Cities to stand at the graveside of his old political pal and someone certainly deserving of respect. And then he just quietly walked away and went home. And that just was so much who Walter Mondale was. I mean, the former vice president of the United States, and he did not request or demand any special attention or accommodation. He just came, paid respect, and then he left.
And carried his own umbrella.
Oh, yep. Yes.
Well, I mean, Patty and I, as we looked over and saw the former vice president standing there by himself, we looked at each other and talked about where on earth would you be to see somebody of this man's stature all by himself, just quietly mourning the passing of a dear friend with no entourage, nobody around him. It was just one of the most solemn yet moving experiences I think you could ever have, just watching that scene on that day. So,
all right. We're speaking with Duke Skorich and Patty McNulty in Duluth and your memories of Walter Mondale in the area. Thanks so much.
Oh, great. Thanks for giving us the opportunity, Robin.
Bye, Robin.
And now we have Fred and Alana Friedman of Duluth, and you've got your personal encounters with the former vice president.
Yeah, from my perspective, this is a man who obviously was incredibly famous, you know, shook hands with world leaders, whatever. But he had a such a mild, positive demeanor. He never walked into a place like he thought everybody should rush toward him. He was always very, very friendly. I don't care who he met. The picture that I posted on Facebook was at Harry Munger's funeral, and I'm passing out bars, you know, I'm the bar lady, and he's over there visiting with me, like, I mean, he didn't know who in the hang I was, and but just this incredibly warm, caring person who cared about the important stuff in life.
And I knew him from when he was attorney general in Minnesota, and then afterwards, and through lawyer stuff. He's, besides all the other great things he did, he wrote the amicus brief to the United States Supreme Court supporting Gideon v. Wainwright, which, as you know, is the case that said poor people have the right to public defenders in criminal matters. Every time I asked him, he remembered that I was the public defender up north. He always asked how work was going, what was going on, what was going on in other parts of the country.
Great. All right.
Hey, good hearing from you, Robin.
And also from the local legal community, we're talking to retired Judge Mark Munger. But he's not in Duluth right now. Where are you?
I am in Kauai, the westernmost Hawaiian island, and watching kids try to boogie board.
Aha. I feel so sorry for you. So tell me your most memorable Mondale encounter.
Well, I've known Fritz my whole life because my dad, Harry, was deeply involved VFL politics, as was my Uncle Willard, who served in the legislature for 43 years. When Mondale ran for the attorney general position in the state of Minnesota back in the early 60s, he and my uncle teamed up and called themselves the M&M Boys.
Mm-hmm. What's the oddest memory?
My oddest memory? Was a story my dad told, and it actually ties into Wisconsin. But my dad was a big fisherman, and there was always a huge debate between Mondale and my father who was the better of the two fishermen. My dad took Fritz in a canoe, and one or the other of the two of them stood up in the canoe to wave at all these adoring fans on the bridge over the brook and promptly flipped the canoe, tossing them and all of their gear into the Brule River.
Very dignified.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Any lesson stand out?
He never stopped caring about America, you know, even up to the end of his days, he was trying to make this a better country. So that's what he instilled in me.
All right. We can't ask for a better lesson than that.
No.
Thank you, Mark Munger.
Thank you.
And next up is Steve Davis of Duluth. What's your Mondale story?
Well, the story goes back about 51 years ago, 1969. I was on the NOIA government tour with the YMCA in collaboration with the school system. And we're going all over the East Coast, and one of the stops we made was in Washington, D.C. and we were supposed to go see Mondale and Humphrey, and we got delayed, two 17-year-old kids, and we didn't know who to meet or where to meet the group. So we stopped by the office building, and Senator Mondale and Senator Humphrey at the time, basically were both there talking to each other and invited us to lunch at the office building. And we actually had lunch with them for the time before meeting the group. And it always amazed me that a senator of that stature would care about two 17-year-old kids who were basically 17-year-old kids. And they just talked about school, what we were doing with the program, not much politics in that part of our life, but, and...
And what did you call him?
Well, we started calling him Senator, and then after a while, he told us about his nickname was Fritz. And he explained to us that even though we were 17 years old and he was a public official, that calling somebody by his first name was nothing bad, as long as you do it respectfully. So he said, call me Fritz, which we did. He was a very down-to-earth person.
Like you would expect a Fritz to be, right?
There you go.
All right. Thank you, Steve Davis.
You're very welcome.
And finally, we're speaking with State Representative Mary Murphy from Hermantown. What's your favorite Mondale memory?
I think my favorite was I ran into him at the Washington National Airport, and it was at Easter. I always went to Maryland for Easter, and he said, well, did you see the cherry blossoms? And I said, no. He says, Mary, they're a myth. Whenever people come to see the cherry blossoms, it was either you should have been here last month, you should have been here next month, you should be here now, or you should be there. No one ever gets to see them except the people that live here. It was so funny. And that,
you know, that, I have the same relationship with the Northern Lights. I have lived
Me too. Tonight's the night. I know tonight's the night. And I go out and they're not there.
Okay, that's a great one. So I have one for you. It's actually for both of us, mm-hmm. right? The year was some time ago. Let's just put it that way. And you guys at the legislature got a bill passed to designate Walter F. Mondale Drive in Duluth.
Yes.
But
Mike Yaros was the author of that.
Right. But a year later, there was no sign up. So I was editorial page editor of the Duluth News Tribune at that time. You couldn't have given us a better gift. And we wrote an editorial yelling at you guys saying, hey, you named this Walter F. Mondale Drive, but you never put up a sign. So a bunch of you arranged that not only would the sign appear a particular day, but on that day of dedication, you would bring Walter Mondale there. You invited me there, and you had a cake that was made up as the editorial page of the Duluth News Tribune with our little Photoshop sign that we had put on, and you were surprising all of us. Remember that?
Yes. Yes, I do. It was by the Hanson Repair Shop. And,
exactly,
and
right
convenience
on Walter
store.
Mondale
yeah.
Drive.
Yeah.
And by the way, I don't think Mondale was worried about his sign, but I remember he did get a chuckle out of the cake.
I do remember that because we felt terrible that there was no sign. But there's still no sign. Every time I drive that road, I look for the Mondale sign, and there is one.
but there is one, right? Exactly. I'm not sure where it is, too.
It's down. It's further south.
Well, south in Duluth can be any direction you want, too.
So. Right, right. That's true. But it's still in everybody's mind, Trinity Road.
No, not for me. For me, it's ever the Fritz. If my car is on the Fritz, it actually means it's working. Well, thank you, Representative Mary Murphy from Hermantown. Thank you for sharing your stories.
Thank you, Robin.
Coming up, a further look at the Catalyst Content Festival and the organization's response after this. Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. Last week, we brought you a special report on the finances of the Catalyst Content Festival and Catalyst Story Institute, formerly known as the Independent Television Festival. Our report follows one we did in July 2019 when we first reported on the event for aspiring TV series producers that had long carried a six-figure debt. The event started in Los Angeles in 2006, then moved to Dover, Vermont, where it was taken over by former HBO staffer Phil Gilpin, whose parents run a bed and breakfast in the Vermont town. After seeking public funds for the festival from Dover and failing to get what he'd hoped, Gilpin moved it to the larger town of Manchester, Vermont in 2017. There, too, it failed to attract the funding that Gilpin said was necessary to bring in just the right Hollywood executives who might use the town for TV locations, and he moved it again to Duluth. He also brought with it a debt of $240,000, which has since almost doubled, while he also sought and received public tax money from the cities of Duluth and Superior, St. Louis County, and the Iron Range Resources and Rehabilitation Board, among others. Here is an excerpt from last week's show.
So the Independent Television Festival Incorporated, which is doing business as Catalyst, does have a score of 65 out of 100 through our Encompass rating system. And so on Charity Navigator, that is a failing score.
Although we first examined Catalyst's financial record back in 2018, we weren't the only ones to do so. The Charity Navigator is a respected online evaluator of nonprofits and provides a rating system based on factors including debt-to-asset ratio. From the Charity Navigator's headquarters in New Jersey, spokesman Kevin Scali explained what the rating means.
The reason why they have a failing score is that they do not have a financial review. And what this means is that the financials that they're presenting to the IRS, there's no sort of outside third party that's validating those numbers. Additionally, we look for a liability to assets ratio of 50% or less. And this organization has a liabilities to asset ratio of 6,400%. And essentially what the liability to assets shows you is the organization's solvency or its long-term sustainability.
To review, contrary to Phil Gilpin's assertion in 2019 that the organization had paid off most of his debts and had assets reaching the millions, tax filings made public since then show no such assets and debt of more than $200,000. That deficit grew in 2019 to $406,000, while the organization took in $750,000 and spent almost all of it, including $280,000 in public funds. Phil Gilpin did not respond to requests for comment on the most recently released tax records. That was an excerpt from our report last week on Catalyst's finances. As we stated, Catalyst's executive director, Phil Gilpin, did not respond to invitations to appear on last week's show. But this Monday, Catalyst board treasurer, Rondi Erickson, replied in an email. She invited me to ask questions to her in an email, and I did, asking specifically about the tax filing and the statements made to me by Gilpin in 2019. In particular, his claim that the organization at that time had assets of more than $1 million.
There's over seven-figure assets on our current balance sheet, but because of the fact that you decided, Robin Washington says, oh, I can only go by the 2017 tax returns, there we go, now it ends. There, you didn't look into what's been happening the last 18 months since then.
Erickson and Gilpin said they were unavailable to join us on air for this broadcast, and they also passed on our invitation for them to read their response themselves. But they did agree for me to read it for them, so I ask you to indulge hearing my voice a little more than usual. Here is their response. Catalyst selected Duluth as its new home venue in 2019 after several years in Vermont. Duluth was chosen because it has all the assets that Catalyst needs to grow and thrive. For the annual festival, it has an airport, quality hotels, restaurants, theaters, scenic beauty, and a vibrant arts and music scene. For the Story Institute, most classes are currently online due to COVID, but the future goal is to expand to offer in-person seminars, and again, Duluth has all the assets needed. Catalyst held a successful festival in the fall of 2019. The organization directly spent over $400,000 to local vendors and people and brought in an additional estimated $1.1 million to the community through the attendees who spent their own money on local lodging, food, and entertainment. The festival exposed TV industry executives to the richness of the area and sparked expansion of the Upper Midwest Film Office and assisted in encouraging the new St. Louis County rebate program. Catalyst is also active with the Upper Midwest Film Office in efforts to build a workforce base here in the Northland to support productions. As we emerge from COVID-19 restrictions, we see positive opportunities for Catalyst and a growing film and TV industry in the Northland. As you know, Catalyst is a not-for-profit. It is chosen to fund its growth through debt because, as a nonprofit, it cannot sell ownership interests and equity shares. You have asked several questions about the debt. No debt is in default, and borrowings have been and will continue to be repaid in full. Catalyst is compliant with federal and Minnesota requirements and has named a 7-member board of directors, the majority of which is female and non-white. Catalyst takes seriously its mission to discover new voices and create pathways for a diverse community of global artists to advance their careers. Catalyst also takes seriously its opportunity to give back to the community by using local vendors and by working cooperatively with other arts and music organizations in the area. For example, the 2019 festival showcased a musical workshop to connect local musicians with TV and film producers seeking music for their works. We believe that working together, we can all win. That was an email from Catalyst Board Treasurer Rondi Erickson. In response, I wrote again, repeating my request that they specifically address the claim that Catalyst had at least $1 million in assets in July 2019. I also asked if any aspiring producers had ever gotten Hollywood contracts as a direct result of Catalyst, and how many productions it had ever attracted to Vermont or the Duluth area. They responded again, and here it is. You have asked about asset representation. Catalyst had a signed agreement that included a 7-figure investment as part of a major sponsor agreement. That sponsorship was terminated prior to fulfillment, and non-disclosure agreements control our ability to share more detail. As for productions, here is a link to a story about Vermont Productions. And, this is Robin speaking as himself now, Erickson provided a link to a Vermont newspaper article saying that the festival led to 2 productions, including filming for ABC's The Bachelor Winter Games and the independent film Storm Chaser. Resuming with her email, Northland Productions that can draw a tie to Catalyst are just at the beginning of the pipeline. Productions are managed by the Upper Midwest Film Office. It is my understanding that 1 has been certified to use the St. Louis County rebate, and 2 additional are in process of being certified. We are again constrained by confidentiality agreements, but the industry standard is that between 40% and 60% of the budgets is allocated for spending on wages. This industry is responsive to financial incentives. We are in the early days of the St. Louis County rebate and are hopeful that this year's legislature will add a Minnesota tax incentive. The combination, plus the triple incentive for productions that also use IRRB funds, will lead to an ongoing and, we believe, growing industry in the area. In addition to our and the Upper Midwest Film Office's training programs to build a base of local employees, we believe the area will attract ancillary for-profit businesses such as specialty equipment rental and sound stages for leasing. That was a response to my second email asking for details from Catalyst Board Treasurer Rondi Erickson. So where are we now? Although several Duluth City Councilors have expressed concern about Catalyst's finances since we first brought it to their attention in 2019, not everyone is displeased. Superior Mayor Jim Payne said that city's $15,000 grant was worth it.
What we were investing in was the opportunity to be advertised among the film industry. And from what I understood is we got that from our money. So there was a book published. There were professionals and advocates and executives and producers from the film industry that were in Duluth that did get access to our content.
Taking a longer view is the former chief administrative officer for the city of Duluth, Dave Montgomery. He retired before Duluth approved his $50,000 grant to Catalyst. With his long career in finance, Montgomery warns that Catalyst's stated practice of financing its growth through debt places everything on achieving success, which is not guaranteed.
Prudent borrowing, selective borrowing, and timely borrowing can be an extremely valuable tool in your overall toolkit for how you grow a business. But if that's the only way you're raising money, then you better be banking on success, because only success is going to allow you to pay off the debt.
Montgomery also says the city and other government entities should take a long, hard look at the track record of whoever they're dealing with and also temper promises with realistic expectations.
I don't fault the city for looking at any opportunities for the use of tourism tax dollars that has a reasonable expectation of attracting significant, you know, additional activity to Duluth, in particular downtown Duluth, and create, you know, more buzz and things like that. However, you know, $50,000 is a lot of money. And your return expectations as a city are always going to be different than like a bank. You know, the city's got a more promotional kind of bent on things sometimes, which is, I think, can at times be appropriate. But all that being said, I think you've got to do some real hard looking and ask some real hard questions about, okay, where can this go? What is a realistic expectation of what we can get out of this? What, forget the money for a second, but whether this can be a successful kind and a successful and sustainable kind of event that can have a benefit commensurate with the amount of money you're putting up. And so I think that just demands that you do a lot of homework. I think it demands that if someone's in promising you the moon, that you do a lot of background homework on that individual. I think seeing, okay, LA, Vermont, Duluth. Okay, what's that about? Why? How did this work out in all the various places that it was? And then sit down with the individual and say, okay, give me a business plan here. Talk to me about how this is actually going to work. I mean, the very fact, anytime you're dealing in, you know, show business, I mean, it's a business. There's very much a business element to that. But there's also a huge amount of promotional fluff to that business. And you've got to be able to dig through that and try to decide, you know, is this realistic or not?
Both emails received from Catalyst this week ended with this remark. We trust this resolves your questions and we can all move forward from here. My final note in this report regarding that last request, as with any story involving public funds, especially with still unanswered questions about the use of those funds and the sustainability of the organization as a whole, the matter has not run its course. As is our journalistic duty, we will continue to report on them as additional information merits, including the release of future tax filings. I'm Robin Washington. We'll be back after this. Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington, and I'm joined by Brooks Johnson of the Star Tribune's North Report team. Hello, Brooks.
Hey, Robin.
And our own Superior-based reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News, Danielle Kading. Hi, Danny.
Hi, Robin.
So the biggest story in the world happened this week. Brooks, what was the reaction in the Twin Ports?
Yeah, well, the verdict came down for former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin this week. Three guilty verdicts prompted essentially a celebration among many of those calling for racial justice in the face of police violence, especially against people of color. In the Twin Ports, about 50 so people gathered at the Clayton Jackson McGee Memorial shortly after the verdict was read on Tuesday afternoon. They marched through the streets chanting George Floyd's name, and many stuck around to say, you know, Dante Wright, Wright being a black man who was shot during a traffic stop in a Minneapolis suburb just last week.
In the case where the officer said she meant to pull the taser and unfortunately used her gun.
Correct. And she has been since charged with manslaughter in that case. And so that is where activist energy is moving toward next, and calls for continued reforms or even the abolition of police departments continue in the wake of the verdicts and the end of the trial, which is now seeing an end of the fortification as it is in Minneapolis, too. As many of my colleagues have pointed out, the boarded up businesses, the fences around the courthouse, all of that is coming to an end for now. But there are still other police officers who will face trial in the death of George Floyd later this summer.
Right. Well, far more local news and not far away from the Clayton Jackson McGee Memorial is Duluth's old City Hall. And there's some plans for it?
Yeah, the former City Hall, which was built and opened in the 1880s, is going to host a 13-room boutique hotel. So this is going to transform the second floor of that building. And anyone who's driven downtown Superior Street near the Fond du Lac Casino will recognize the building as the current home of the Wasabi restaurant, which will stay as the hotel is put into place. So this old building, it was extensively remodeled in the past decade after the owners of the Vickers Brewhouse bought it, put in the Rathskeller speakeasy in the basement, and now are moving to give some pretty cool views and cool rooms to visitors who want to come up and have a taste of, I guess, Duluth's storied history.
Well, one of those cool views might be looking out at the lake, and if you look, you might see the first salty.
Yeah, it came through under the lift bridge on Sunday, and it was celebrated with the traditional first ship ceremony. A bunch of officials, including Mayor Emily Larson and Deb DeLuca, the executive director of the Port of Duluth Superior and the Duluth Seaway Authority, gathered on this the Federal Biscay, a Marshall Islands flag vessel, which came with cement from Turkey. It was a celebration of global commerce, and actually, you know, being there on the ship, it felt like, you know, we're reaching that little bit of post-pandemic normal. It was nice to be around people again, even though we were all wearing masks and well distanced. It was a semblance of normalcy as we kind of continue into hopefully a rebound for the shipping industry, which was certainly hurt last year, especially by a big drop in steel demand, which has since recovered.
You know, our transportation and logistics expert, Dr. Richard Stewart from UWS, is always talking about the interconnectedness of transportation and logistics, moving things around. And yes, you just said we're getting cement from Turkey. I did not know that.
For projects here in the Twin Ports and all the way up into Canada as it gets shipped on rail, well beyond. Pretty interesting.
All right. Well, Danny, speaking of Lake Superior, where can I get a bottle of Lake Superior water or something close to that?
Well, you won't get it from Bayfield County, where a northern Wisconsin couple had proposed to bottle and sell water from a well on their land near Lake Superior. Bayfield County Committee shot down a permit for their proposal last week after a bunch of residents voiced concerns that it would harm the area watershed. Herbster area couple Crystal Myshak and Robert Glau had applied for a permit in the county to install underground storage tanks that would capture water from an artesian well for their company Crystal Clear. And that water would then be collected by tanker trucks and transported offsite to be bottled at a facility here in Superior. The couple had proposed selling this water in Wisconsin and Minnesota, as well as online to customers across the country. But their plans drew a lot of backlash. The county received more than 60 letters of opposition. Some of the people who spoke out said the proposal violated the spirit of the Great Lakes Compact, which is a landmark agreement that aims to protect the lakes from the threats of water diversions outside the basin. And I would say, you know, around 36 people came and spoke during a public hearing last Thursday, talking about how this proposal threatens the environment and the area watershed, saying that there wasn't a lot of detail surrounding how it would impact groundwater in the area or nearby properties. a representative of the Red Cliff tribe said that they were concerned about how this would impact waterways and wetlands in the area and could set a dangerous precedent for water withdrawals in the area. The couple that applied for this permit said that according to the law that implements the Great Lakes Compact in Wisconsin, that, you know, this is not a diversion, that you can transport bottles of water of roughly 6 gallons or less outside of the basin. But people kind of pointed out that, you know, that really wasn't the intent of the legislation. You know, if you're going to be doing, you know, multiple containers of bottles of water, 6 gallons or less, then really it's not the exception under the law. So this was shot down by the county committee unanimously, but the couple does have 30 days to appeal the denial.
All right. Well, if I can't have crystal clear water, how about some pure, delightful air?
Yeah, well, according to the latest report from the American Lung Association, most of Wisconsin was breathing cleaner air over the last several years. They issued a report this week that found that areas like the Duluth Superior region and the Shawamigan Bay area had some of the best air quality in the states of Minnesota and Wisconsin. You know, they saw 0 days where ozone pollution exceeded federal standards. And ozone pollution is when air pollutants that like nitrogen oxides and volatile organic compounds interact with heat and sunlight during the summer and cause problems for people, generally respiratory issues like worsening asthma or potentially even increasing chronic health issues like emphysema or lung cancer down the road. And these generally come from industry, those emissions, you know, power plants, vehicles, things like that. And so part of the reason they think that the air quality was improving is that, you know, the last several years that they were looking at in this report were somewhat cooler than they saw in the previous report. But also they noted that, you know, 2017, 2018, and 2019, which were the years that they looked at, were still among the 6 hottest years on record across the globe. And as climate change drives those temperatures up, there's concern that that warmer weather will make it more likely for ozone pollution to form. But the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources says that the grades that the American Lung Association is giving really are not based on compliance with federal standards because they're looking at it in a different way. The US EPA has different measures by which they determine whether health objectives are being met, whereas the American Lung Association is just looking at the hard data and taking a rolling average of the days where they saw high ozone levels that exceeded those federal standards. So there's a little bit of disagreement over, you know, whether or not the information that's being portrayed by the Lung Association is actually a risk to human health as the US EPA would measure it.
All right. Well, however you measure it, the air is still free, but public services aren't in Ashland. They're still facing tough times.
Yeah. You know, as we've talked about before, Ashland County had looked to raise property taxes by almost $1 million for the next 5 years, but they had a referendum earlier this month that failed. And so now they're trying to figure out what to do because they're facing financial problems in the county. And so as part of that, the county board met this week and they discussed whether or not to institute a hiring freeze. And eventually they did vote to do just that. And there was quite a bit of debate regarding that among the board. You know, some board members felt that they should wait and see if this was a measure that they actually needed. Others felt that the hiring freeze was necessary to show to people that they're doing something about the county's financial problems. And so now, you know, they won't be hiring for any new positions. Those that were already in the process are still going through that process. But in order to hire for new positions, that would require the approval of the county administrator and also the county board chair under the vote they took this week. And it's possible that, you know, the county could cut anywhere from 6 to 8 positions, but it still kind of remains to be seen what's going to shake out for the rest of this year. You know, the question of the federal COVID relief also factors into this, of whether they can't use it for their general fund, but maybe it could help alleviate expenses elsewhere and potentially free up some money in the budget. So we'll see what happens as they continue to review the county's budget as they go along.
All right. Well, we hope they find a solution. We've been speaking with Danielle Kading, the Superior-based reporter for WPR News. Thank you, Danny.
Thank you, Robin.
And Brooks Johnson of the Star Tribune's North Report team. Thank you, Brooks.
Thank you, Robin.
You can read the stories by Brooks and the Star Tribune's entire Twin Ports Bureau at www.startribune.com/North Report. And if you haven't subscribed to their local newsletter, do it. Coming up next week, if we gave you a Democratic vice president with our tributes to Walter Mondale, how about a Republican president? We'll hear how George W. Bush has immortalized a local person in portraiture. That's it for this edition of Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. We leave you with the music of Sarah Thompson, who has an online Earth Day concert today. Details are at sarahthompson.com. That's SarahThompson.com. Here's Song Like a Seed. Stay safe, everyone.
I want to sing about in these days. What rhyme or melody turn a phrase? What is your story now? Where is your gaze? I want to sing about in like a tree, set your soul.